Welcome back to The Source on KSTX 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. There are at least three public statues of Abraham Lincoln in New York City that I'm aware of. You would think today by looking at this, these statues that New York City loves Abraham Lincoln, and they did so even in the days of the Civil War, and you would be wrong. New York actually loathed, hated him, and they supported the South. They talked about secession from the Union itself, and they rioted in the streets in opposition to fighting for the Union. It's worth remembering that this is an American history episode that just shows us the messy reality of 1860 America, and particularly in the most populated city in America at the time and in the Union. It's written about in the book called The City of Sedition, The History of New York City During the Civil War, and it's written by John Strasburg, and he is the Weekend Explorer video podcast host for the New York Times. He's an American author and cultural commentator. And John, welcome to The Source. John, you there?
Dave?
Yes, sir.
Hi.
Hey, so fascinating book. You're looking at the streets of New York City during the run-up to the Civil War and during the Civil War and post-war also. But why did you take – you've written such amazing topics, incredible stories you've taken on. Why did you pick this up?
I love writing about New York City history. It's so deep and, as you said, so messy and fragmented, and you can just go crazy looking into it. And so I got completely absorbed by looking into New York City during the Civil War, and the more I learn, the more it runs against the grain of a lot of what we think about Civil War. So that made it, you know, even more interesting.
Shows us the complexities of the time. People like to boil the Civil War and the sentiments behind it down into very simplistic terms. See that in New York City at the time, it was. You write that it was a blessing and a bane for Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that he would not have gotten into the White House if it weren't for his supporters in New York City. They arranged for him to do his famous speech at Cooper Union in February of 1860. At that point, he wasn't even a dark horse. He was not a candidate for the presidency. He was such a nobody that half the papers in New York misspelled his name. However, it was New York City, so it was the media center of the country. The newspapers all went out around the whole rest of the country. So if you did well in New York, you could do well almost anywhere. And he did, and went on to be elected just barely by the skin of his teeth, but he got elected. At the same time, the vast majority of New Yorkers despised him, loathed him, were very hostile to him and his policies from day one and throughout the war. That had its different reasons. That's because New York was so dependent on the international cotton trade. Cotton had grown up just extraordinarily in the 1800s, from exporting, I think it was 500,000 pounds of cotton in 1800. They were exporting more than 2 billion in 1860, and an awful lot of that was going out through New York. New York banks were funding the plantations. New York merchants were supplying them. So New York and the South had a very intimate and long relationship. And New York was very pro-South, very pro-slavery, very anti-Lincoln.
So people just don't really, that doesn't register with them that would be the case. But an important distinction is, of course, New York City and then New York State. Across upper New York State, there was deep and popular support for Abraham Lincoln, which is why he was able to get those 33 electoral votes and be reelected as president.
Yeah, New York City voted against him more than 2-1, but the rest of the state voted for him. Much of the rest of the state was Republican, which he was at the time. That was the Liberal Party at that time. But New York City was deeply Democrat, which was the Conservative Party, and so that's why. Brooklyn as well. New York and Brooklyn were still separate cities, and they both voted against him overwhelmingly.
So we hear about the draft riots in New York City. They needed men to fight for the union, and frequently they took people who were right off the boat, who arrived, immigrated into the United States, and they were drafted immediately. And there was there were riots in the streets to avoid the draft.
Yeah, the conscription was the immediate cause of the riots, but things had been building up with working class New Yorkers for some time by then, through the whole rest of the war. The riots were in the summer of 1863, and, you know, so the war had been going on for 2 years by then. Volunteerism had dropped to a trickle after the horrors of the first 2 years of the war. So that's why they had to have a draft. Rich men could opt out of the draft by paying a $300 fee. $300 was the annual salary of most workers at that time. So they said it was a rich man's war, but a poor man's fight. And it just all added up to 2 days after the first names were pulled out of what people called the Wheel of Misfortune. They rioted in the streets. And it's still to this day the deadliest rioting in American history.
The Wheel of Misfortune was a barrel?
It was a barrel with all the names in it of the eligible males, and they would spin it and reach in, you know, like when they do lotto and the state lottos and stuff, and they just reached in and started pulling out names.
But was there, wasn't there a lot of abolitionist, anti-slavery sentiment, in New York City also?
It was very strong, but they were a minority. In some ways, New York was fighting its own civil war. And in some ways, that was between the North and the South in the city. There was a very pro-Southern, I would say the majority, you don't have to say it, it is. The majority of New Yorkers were very pro-Southern. But there was a very strong abolitionist voice. Most of them came down from New England. They were businessmen and merchants from New England, or like Horace Greeley, a newspaper man. But they had all been born and raised in New England, which was a stronghold of abolitionism, and they brought that with them to New York City. So the two were constantly at loggerheads.
And in your book, we follow Walt Whitman quite a bit. Talk about his role.
Yeah. I love Walt. You know, when you read Leaves of Grass today, it reads like it was written last week. It's just amazing how far ahead of his time he was as a writer. But Walt also is an interesting character, in that although he was, he came to like Lincoln very much and admired him very much, he came into the abolitionist movement very slowly because he was another Brooklynite, another New Yorker, did not have the highest opinion of black people, which I should say, you know, we forget, and it's easy to forget, that until relatively recently, most white people in America thought that black people were inferior and held some degree of what we would now consider white supremacist and racist ideas about them. And that was certainly true in the 1850s and 1860s. So even abolitionists, a lot of people in the North, not just in the South, did not have very good attitudes about black folks and were not particularly interested in seeing slavery end in the South.
Right. And Walt Whitman, of course, wrote Lilies and Captain, My Captain, about
yeah.
Abraham Lincoln, and eulogized him in his poetry. So worth reading and just
grateful.
Devouring. We're going to talk more about City of Sedition, New York City in the time of the Civil War. Our phone lines are open. Please call in 210-614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. New York City may have been the largest city in the Union during the Civil War, but most of its inhabitants were strongly opposed to the civil conflict, if not downright hostile to the Union's war aims. During the secession crisis in 1861, the pro-Union mayor even proposed seceding from the Union and establishing itself as an independent city-state. We're talking about the City of Secession, New York City during the Civil War, and we're speaking with the author about the book. He is John Strasbaugh, and you may know him from the New York Times A Weekend Explorer video podcast, which if you haven't checked it out, you really ought to. It's really cool. And he just writes about cool stuff all the time. John, how would that have worked? How could New York City even consider that it could secede from the Union?
That was Mayor Fernando Wood. All the other newspapermen, or rather all the newspapermen at the time, thought it was an absurd idea. But it had been raised before. You could be a free city-state there, some now, especially port cities. They make themselves international cities. It's not the craziest idea, and as I see, you know, any potential for Donald Trump to become president, I'm raising the issue again in New York City.
Okay. Let's get a caller on the air. 210-614-8980. I'm not touching that. 210-614-8980. Lee has called in. Lee, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I really like your program.
Thank you.
And I'd like to know how many men died in the New York draft riots and what was the ratio between law enforcement and civilian deaths?
All right, thank you for the question, Lee.
Good question, Lee. Yeah, yeah. The official count was 119, most of whom were supposedly rioters. There were anywhere from 6 to 24 black men who were lynched. There was very little in the way of law enforcement at the time, which is one of the reasons the riot could run as long as it did. It ran almost a week. But there were militiamen and later troops who came in. Some of them were killed. Some of them had their weapons taken from them, and they were beaten to death with them. Most New Yorkers at the time thought 119 was a very low estimate and thought there were hundreds more, but we'll never know.
Another caller, Hugh, is on the line. Hugh, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
How did Catholicism and anti-Catholicism fit in with all those factions?
All right, Hugh.
That's another good question.
Yeah, anti-Catholicism was pretty strong at the time.
Yeah, and still relatively new and still feeling very beleaguered. America was still very much a Protestant place. New York was very much a Protestant city, so Catholics felt under the gun. Catholicism grew, it exploded exponentially from about the 1840s up to the war because of all the Irish immigrants. And also about a third of the German immigrants who were coming during that time. There was just a tsunami of Irish and Germans. Almost all the Irish were Catholics. A lot of the Germans were Catholics. So suddenly Protestants who had been worried about Catholicism for some time, now they feel that they're surrounded by it. The church itself in America, in terms of the war and slavery and all that, took a relatively hands-off stand about it all because they didn't want to, the bishops and archbishops didn't want to offend anybody on either side because they were already having to defend Catholicism every day. So they kind of were mute on the issues.
So even John Hughes, the Archbishop of New York at the time, didn't speak out?
His opinion was that as long as slavery was legal where it was legal, then it wasn't a sin. The only sin would be to mistreat a person who was your slave.
Now, Tammany Hall, you mentioned the Irish, and Tammany was anti-Irish originally, but then they switched sides as the demographics became apparent later down the road.
Yeah.
But what role did they play, Tammany?
Tammany played a huge role, not so much in the early years of the war, but after the riots, it was William Tweed and Tammany who came up with a program, a brilliant program, to buy the commutations for all the men in New York City, or almost all the men in New York City, who were drafted. So they had a fund that they raised, and they would pay your $300 so you didn't have to serve. So after all the deaths and all the rioting and all the complaining about being drafted, very few New Yorkers from that point on, from the institution of the draft, went into uniform who weren't doing it because they wanted to. And that was Tammany's a rather brilliant maneuver. They came up with a whole bureaucracy to keep New Yorkers out of Mr. Lincoln's army.
And you mentioned Boss Tweed. He's a fascinating character in New York history, and eventually he became a congressman, so it's always worth knowing that that's where he ended up.
The period, because so many people at that period were self-made men and self-made women, you find just they're all fascinating and remarkable characters. If they were alive today, we'd just be standing in awe of whether they were good characters or bad characters. They were larger than life.
And what about the gangs of New York, the Dead Rabbits and what have you?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of them, in the first flush of the war, right after the bombardment of Fort Sumter, a lot of them signed up. There was a lot of volunteerism. Part of that was because there was a very high degree of unemployment in New York City at the time. So it was a job, and it was a pay packet that you would get once a week. Also, at that time, they figured the war was going to be over in 2-3 months. They were going to march south, they were going to kick some butt, and they were going to come back victorious. So lots and lots of guys signed up. Whole brigades, like Dan Sickles' Excelsior Brigade, was made up of guys who had been in street gangs the week before, and now they're in uniform. A lot of them didn't perform all that well once they actually got to the battlefield, and many of them, once they saw what war is really like at Bull Run, or Manassas, as it is called, and some of the other early battles, when their initial sign-up period came due, which was only about 3 months to start with, they skedaddled.
And so, I mean, we had things like the 39th New York Infantry, the Garibaldi Guard. I mean, that's a much storied collective of fighters.
The Garibaldis are amazing. You know, immigrants in New York volunteered in huge numbers. Germans, Hungarians, Italians. Well, there weren't tons of Hungarians or Italians, but there were a lot of Germans. The Garibaldi was the most multi-ethnic, multilingual unit in the Northern Army. It was said that officers couldn't talk to one another because they all spoke different languages. But they served very well and very bravely.
So what is the takeaway from remembering this chapter in New York City history? Are people in New York, are they not aware?
I think if you ask 10 New Yorkers about the Civil War, 9 would mention the riots. Everybody knows about the draft riots, but very little else. And that's true, I think, around the country. New York has kind of faded out of the telling of the narrative of the Civil War. I think partly that's because it's just a kind of a confused story, because they were on both sides and they were confused themselves. But it's also, I think, because Civil War is told most often now as military history. You know, we know down to the minutest detail what went on at the Battle of Fredericksburg or Chancellorsville, but we don't know much about the huge influence that New York had on the war at the time.
Or about the ideas and the people had, you know, which they clung on to. Right now we're talking about here are in the United States so divided, and we can say it's maybe the most divided time since the Civil War.
It's quite possible, and it's interesting to me that in both instances there seems to be a lot of fear driving both sides. You know, now we know that we have fear of terrorists, we have fear of that, fear of the other thing. At that time, too, the South feared Lincoln. They feared the Republicans. The North feared, or at least workers in the North, feared the release of 4 million slaves because they were terrified that they'd come North and steal their jobs. So there was a lot of unreasoning fear on both sides, and I think that's not unlike the way things are now.
Right, and the South just felt that when Lincoln was elected, that automatically would end slavery, even though he said over and over again that was not his objective when he was running for president.
Yeah, I don't think it was. There are scholars who have examined his words closely, and they can interpret them in any way they like, but if you just look at what he said and what he did, he had no intention at first of ending slavery in the South. The war was about expanding slavery to all that vast territory in the West that had been opened up in the years just prior to the war.
So what about outside agitators, I mean, particularly from Great Britain? Were they present? Were they trying to stir up trouble in New York City?
The British pretty much stayed out of it. They were supportive of the South because of the cotton industry, but not uniformly. When Reverend Beecher from Brooklyn went to England and spoke out against slavery and against Britain getting involved, because the North was terrified that if the British got involved, the British Navy would just dominate. And they stayed out of it. The agitators in New York were generally native New Yorkers.
And they did cooperate with the Southerners to put torch to the city.
Yeah, when Confederate saboteurs came to town, A newspaper editor and several others in New York helped them hide their material, hide themselves, help them get themselves set up. And there, people in New York also colluded with John Wilkes Booth, Lincoln's assassin.
The name of the book. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Just, I was just going to wrap you up, but you know, John Wilkes Booth and his long history of performing on the stage and his family in New York City. That's also worth exploring. The City of Sedition is the name of the book, The History of New York City During the Civil War. The author is John Strosbaugh. He is also the New York Times. He does the Weekend Explorer New York video podcast, and that's something worth catching. John, it was great talking with you.
Same here, David. Thank you very much.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Thanks for tuning us in.